Now people want to do things. I'm like, yep, we'll do that. You know, like just taking what people want to offer and accepting it like with gratitude is better than telling like people no all the time, because people really do want to help. The nature of people is mostly good.
Sure.
And so I just think like learning how to accept the help and lean into that, and then like applying what you're innately good at already, and rest. Those are the ways that I do it.
Welcome to the Longevity Formula with Dr. Brandon Crawford. Let's explore the new era of wellness.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us again on the Longevity Formula podcast. So I'm your host, Dr. Brandon Crawford. Today is going to be an extraordinary discussion. I have Lauren Frank, and Lauren is the wife of Illinois State Trooper Brian Frank. And this is a story about resilience. It's a story about hope. It's going to be extremely moving is what I'm wanting to capture. But there's so many different pieces about this story that I want to talk about. So let's first just say thank you, Lauren, for joining us. I really appreciate you doing this. So would you start by telling us a little bit about who you are and giving us a little bit about the story that is unfolding?
Yeah, I am Brian's wife, and we're both from Chicago. We grew up in different towns. We met later in life, but Brian and I were married in 2018, and 2 years into our marriage is when he was hit on the job at work. So I quit my job and became his like sole caregiver. We have 24/7 care, but I navigate all of the brain injury and what comes with it.
Yeah. So can you give me a little bit about, well, let's just do this. How did you and Brian meet? I know we talked about that a little bit initially, but yeah. Can you give me a little bit of the backstory?
Yeah. So we met through mutual friends. Brian and my friend Matt work for the state police. But Matt and I go back to high school. We worked together at my first like part-time job. And I set him up with his wife in college. And then about 12 years later, when he got on with the state, he was working a lot with Brian. And we all went on a ski trip. That's when I met Brian initially, but it wasn't until like 3 months later we went on our first date. And I was like, well, I'm going to marry that guy. So,
right. He kind of stole you away, didn't he?
Yeah, he definitely did.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, he's a profound guy. I mean, just the moment you brought him into the office, I mean, he's very strong, obviously a good looking dude. What was his personality like?
Yeah, Brian's like everybody's best friend. He's like, he's super humble. He's funny. He's good at everything, but in a way that like he wants you to be good with him. He doesn't want to like show off his skills. He just wants to show you all the things he learned so that you could just be really good with him, so that probably you could compete with him. I think he just wanted everybody on his level, but I think he doesn't even realize that he is like the light in the room all the time. And people all want to sit with Brian and talk to him, and you feel like you've known him your whole life with like just one conversation. So
yeah,
he's great.
I noticed there's almost like an inside joke, almost like a sound you make. Was that something that Brian used to do? Like a laugh or something? You did it just earlier.
Oh, the Brian thing?
Yeah.
We have a lot of things. No, that was probably just a Haley thing.
Oh. Okay, good deal. Well, so is he like a jokester?
Yeah, yeah. So we were the people on our block when we bought our house that didn't have kids. Everyone on the block was like a young family or had been there their whole life when they had kids and grandkids and all that. We were like the newlyweds on the block. And Brian was like, man, and he went to Goodwill. He bought New Balance white, like grass stained shoes and tall socks. And he'd tuck his t-shirt into like some basketball shorts and mow the lawn so he could look like a dad with all the other guys on the block.
Yeah.
And then when I get home from work, he'd be in that, you know, just had mowed the lawn. I'll pull in the driveway and he'd stand on the front porch and be like, hi, Jenny, like Forrest Gump, like his favorite movie, just a dork. Yeah.
Awesome. I think I would get along with him just from the dad joke perspective. Yeah. It's a guy thing.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
So he was a state trooper, but you were telling me beyond that, like his focus was
drug interdiction. Yeah. Yes. Brian did drug interdiction.
So can you elaborate just a little bit on that? Because when I, you know, it's hard to kind of think about how someone like Brian is like really keeping us safe and like what the kind of work that he does entails.
Yeah. So Brian initially he was patrol. So he worked the roads, like what you think with state police. So speeding tickets, DUIs, that kind of thing. And then he got on the CRIMPAT team, which stood for Criminal Patrol. And pretty much it's a balance of, there's a lot of psychology that went into that role for him. And I think that's what made him really good at it, is he was really good at winning people over and his demeanor with them. And so pretty much like drug interdiction is trying to stop the end deal of a drug sale, I guess. I'm going to butcher that.
That's fine.
He's going to roll his eyes at it. But if somebody was trying to transport drugs from Mexico up to New York or California to New York or wherever across the country, they would do it on I-80 via a vehicle.
Okay.
So either a truck, a bus, a car. If it's a car, it's usually someone looks like an everyday person gets hired to be the mule, transport the drugs, and they get paid, and that's that. And so Brian was looking for people like that who might have a large amount of illegal guns, drugs, and money in the car, pull them over. He would put them in the front seat of his car and have like an interview with them and basically try to win them over enough to where they would cooperate and let him do a controlled delivery. Mm. So that would just be them granting the right to the state police to drive the vehicle, call the FBI, SWAT, whoever they need to do, and stop the operation from happening.
Right.
Yeah. So, and he was one of the best in our state and one of the best in the nation, which I found out after the crash when I accepted all his awards for his skill.
Right. Yeah. You were telling me about that. Yeah. So from a wife's perspective, mm-hmm. I mean, how did that make you feel knowing that Brian was going out like doing this kind of work?
Yeah. I did a ride along with him when we were engaged and I got to see kind of how it went, and it made it less scary. There were scary parts of it that I learned, of course, like he would put his thumbprint on the back of every car he pulled over in case something happened to him. If the driver assaulted him or hurt him or drove off, then his fingerprint would be on that vehicle and would be part of evidence later, which is forethought stuff that just really freaked me out. But the actual work he was doing, it was impressive, and he was so himself on the job and he was so good at talking to people that it made it less scary to me. And I wasn't actually truly worried about him in the criminal patrol role that he was in. I was more worried about the fact that he was always in a car and just knowing the statistics on troopers getting hit. He always told me it's not a matter of if I get hit, it's when. Yeah. So I kind of had this newfound anxiety that came after I realized that the drug part wasn't scary. It's actually just him getting in the car every single day, and the car is his office. So I knew there was a part of me deep down that knew he was going to get hit one day. I just would have never expected this to be the result.
Sure.
Yeah.
So I had no idea. Like, that's actually something I've never thought about. It's not a matter of if you get hit, but when, mm-hmm. for these people that literally make this country as safe as it is. Mm-hmm. That's kind of heart-wrenching.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
So how did that play out? How did this accident happen?
Yeah. So his unit doesn't have to do typical patrol duties because of what they do. They're a specialty unit. So, but the state was understaffed or, you know, in certain districts. And so whenever there was inclement weather, like we get a lot of snow, they would call for broader teams to come in and kind of flood those areas and help support for what they knew would be increased crashes or anything like that. So the night before the crash, it was Valentine's Day. And I remember Brian was looking at the weather before bed and he was like, it's going to be really bad tomorrow. They're probably going to call our unit out. It's optional for their unit, but they collectively decided like, we're going to help. They need our help. And I begged him not to. I was like, just stay. Like, it is going to be really bad. I had so much anxiety about him going. I begged him not to go, but he was like, this is like my responsibility, you know, to the public. I have to go. And it was no convincing to be had. Like, there was nothing I could have said to him that would have changed his mind. So I know he was doing what he felt in his heart was right. So he went out, he handled a lot of crashes that morning, and it was like 11. He said his boots were soaking wet. He was going to come home and change them and go back out. Mm-hmm. On his way home, he assisted a crash. It was a single truck crash. A trooper had already pulled it over, but she called for assistance to close the lane so that cars would go around it so it wouldn't pile up. Mm-hmm. He closed the lane. He put out some flares, got back into his car, and a 20-year-old hit him at 80 miles an hour. Didn't even initiate the brakes. So he was he was hit with that impact, fully stopped inside his car.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I don't think I heard this from you, but I heard from other sources that, I mean, there were several hundreds of cars that went by during that time, right?
Yeah.
So it wasn't like, you know, this wasn't marked off. This was.
Yeah, lights activated, flares out. Like,
yeah,
I think it was the crash report said like almost 500 cars successfully went around him.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So with that, right? So what were some of like the immediate challenges, if you will, right? So obviously he was, you know, taken into acute care. What were some of those immediate like challenges that you were really facing and trying to navigate?
So I got the call obviously from his boss, but I was on a Zoom call for work, so I didn't get it immediately. So by the time I called back, there was already a trooper like pulling in my driveway to take me to the hospital. And they said that he was, had been airlifted. I also didn't know that an airlift meant that he was on like a life flight. In my mind, I was like, he's on an air ambulance because the weather, and that would get him there faster. And I'm glad I didn't know, because I was scared, but I wasn't like, he might not be alive sort of thing.
Right.
And everybody kept saying like, we don't know what happened. We just know he's alive and he's breathing. So I got there, I called, you know, my family and everybody that needed to know. And then the doctors came in to let me know, like, he suffered a severe brain injury. We're going to go do brain surgery on him right now. And I think there was just nobody at any point that slowed down to really navigate any of that with me in a way that made any sense. Like, of course they were throwing information at me constantly about what his pressures were in his brain and what his lungs were doing and what level of like sedation he was at. There was a lot of information flooding in, but I really didn't know like what this was going to look like, what it meant. I looked at him and he looked good to me. He was of course on a ventilator, but I thought that that would come out and that he would wake up after they removed the sedation. And so for the first week or two, I think I was just in this state of like, he looks good. And so he'll be okay. Mm-hmm. And even in the moments where they were like, you're going to have to make a really hard decision and, you know, maybe remove the ventilator if he's brain dead in a couple days from now, I still was like, that's not even on my radar.
Right.
Like, I remember looking at them and being like, no, like telling a whole team of neurologists, like, no, you're wrong. Like he's fine.
Yeah.
Obviously we're not fine and it's been 3 years and it's still not, you know, fine. But yeah, I just think the whole thing has been really, really challenging to navigate even still today. But now I have a better picture of like what I can and can't do with Brian, or like what's overstimulating versus not. Just learning kind of what it all means.
Right. So because we do have medical people that tune in as well. For them to understand from your perspective, how can someone, whether it's a doctor, a nurse, someone, how can they help you, someone like you in these times? Is there anything that you can say like, man, if someone just would have sat down and said, this is the type of brain injury that we think he has, and this is kind of what the process is going to be. Is there some kind of structure that you would suggest or say, man, if you could have just done this for me?
Yeah. I think about it all the time. I think if they wouldn't have given me so many options to quit, it would have been a little less scary. I understand that there is this responsibility as a healthcare provider and a doctor to kind of paint the whole picture of possibility. Like this could end really badly. This could be the way it goes. You know, they have a right to a responsibility to inform me, but there was a lot of information given with also this pivot of like, but if at any point you don't want to be aggressive, or if at any point you want to give up, that's okay too. And we can talk about what that looks like. And I think that permission to like, to quit made me feel like, well, like it made me pause every time, be like, well, then do you think that I'm a fool? Like, am I missing something? Are you leaving something out that I'm not understanding? Because I'm talking to the case manager over here about acute care, rehab, like this going home stuff, like goals to move toward recovery. And I'm agreeing with that and I'm moving forward and I'm choosing that. And you are aware that that's my choice, but you're still kind of pulling me aside being like, but if not, let me know. And I think that that always, and still to this day, sticks with me as like a, almost like sits on my shoulder. Like, am I doing wrong by Brian? Like, am I crazy for thinking that there could be a quality of life and that he could have this recovery where he wakes up and returns to society?
Right.
Yeah.
Was anyone at that moment, or anyone in that hospital setting, able to say, we've seen similar injuries and this is what they look like 2 years from now, 3 years from now, 5 years from now?
Mostly no. There's a couple people like stand out in my mind that I remember saying, well, there's one doctor on his team that I believe is the reason he's still here and alive. And he saw Brian and he said, you know, my brother had a severe traumatic brain injury and he died from it, but it was much worse than what Brian's presenting. And so I believe in Brian and I know I'm going to shake his hand one day. Mm-hmm. And he said that to me and he was like the one person that extended that hope to me in the early days where I just looked at him and believed him.
Right.
And he got Brian a experimental treatment of, it was an omega-3 trial. Mm-hmm. And he was like, this basically stops the cells from continuing to rupture, explode. There's like a effect in the brain after you get hit where the cells start to die and it's almost like a radiates through the brain and they keep dying. So the omega treatment is supposed to prevent that from happening.
Yeah.
And so he offered that to him when the rest of the doctors all disagreed and they all said, no, like he doesn't need it. It's kind of a goner.
Wow.
But he was like, I'm going to shake Brian's hand one day.
Yeah.
And I held that for a long time. And there really, truthfully, hasn't really been any other doctors since then that have made me feel the same way. There's been nice things said, but it's all laced with the, but if not, you know, we feel for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just from my perspective, I think that's a big component that's missing in the hospital setting. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we need the acute care and we need all of these specialists coming in and helping out and doing all of these life-saving things. However, we're the ones that get to then engage with patients like Brian. And we're the ones that say, hey, based on this, we've seen people progress like this. And if you choose that route, mm-hmm. this is what we've seen. And this, so I wish, this is just my wish, I wish that there was more collaboration between programs like what we have and those acute care scenarios, because I feel like there should be almost like a handoff.
Yeah. Yeah. Like a next step.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause our next step was like nursing home or home.
Right.
And that, I mean, I chose to go home. It took me 2 years to get him home. So we lived in a hospital that whole time. And I would stay up all night just honestly looking at your Instagram and any Instagram like it, you know, Dr. Kyle, like just that was what I would like stay up at night looking at. Cause I'm like, I need to know. Cause I know in my heart that Brian's in there. Like I can tell he's there. Mm-hmm. And but I was like, but I need to see other people's stories. And like the ones I were getting were like, oh, people who woke up after 1 week or 2 week, there's just not a space for long-term recovery patients. Right. And like, they're not talking about it and I'm like, is it because they're so tired that they don't want to share their story? Like, and then, you know, it's like the more I prayed about it and the more I looked into like what you guys are doing, I would just start to uncover these longer term recovery stories. And I was like, okay, so I'm not crazy. And that was relief in and of itself. I could sleep at night by knowing there's one person that woke up after 5 years and returned to society. Like, okay, that's all I needed.
Yes.
Cause it's not impossible. And that's all I needed to like kind of get up and keep doing it every day.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a good conversation I had yesterday with someone in your support group, which you have an amazing support group. They asked me, is Brian in there? And I kind of looked at him like they were crazy. And I'm like, of course he's in there. Like the moment he came into the clinic, I knew he was in there. Mm-hmm. I've seen, and this is not a story about me, but I've seen enough to where when you look at someone's facial tone, when you look at their eyes, you know whether they're in there or not. And then you back it up with a QEEG study or, you know, whatever. Like it's very obvious that he's present, right? And I don't think that there's a huge difference, you know, between now and maybe a year ago or 2 years ago, you know, in that being true. And there's also studies, and the majority of these studies come out of the non-fatal drowning community, yeah. But there are studies that will show you that cognitive skills and processing and everything is oftentimes maintained, even if motor control, right? You're not able to move the body and whatnot is not. So that is something that I think is very much missing in medicine right now is, number one, let's look at these studies and then let's really acknowledge the cognitive ability of the person. And there's a lot of therapeutic strategies that can be, you know, that you can take from that as far as bringing someone back, if you will, and giving them a voice and giving them purpose and helping them to function. What are some things, right? So obviously this has been a huge impact. Like, how has this really impacted just like your daily life? Like even just little things, I mean, routines and schedules mm-hmm. and your job and like, what does this look like?
It's Groundhog's Day, which is maddening for one, because for a long time, I really had the picture of like what they put in the movies mm-hmm. where someone just wakes up and then right. you like return to your life. Mm-hmm. And so I think there was this like maddening almost year of like praying for the same thing and like seeing nothing really come to fruition from that. And hearing more and more people start to speak negatively about it or like give me permission to quit or ask me like, when are you going to put them in a home? And friends start to fall off the radar. And it's just like, it was like this total life purge. It was like, I don't have the one person that I need to comfort me right now because it's Brian and he can't. And I don't have, I'm like starting to lose these support groups that I really envisioned having. Not that we don't have an amazing support group, as we truly do. And like, it's beyond words for me at this point with it being almost like a national support group of right. people that I don't even know. But those people you pictured being there kind of don't know what to do or don't react the way you think they would. And as time goes on, they just, my whole life just slowly unraveled. And I had to like almost like live and exist to watch both of our lives fall apart in a way that I never expected. And then I also had the privilege to see the beauty in what that looked like too. Like the people that did step into my life or stayed in my life and how they responded and how they treated Brian. I mean, I really had to like take like my blinders off entirely and try to grab onto the beautiful stuff in order to like really get up and keep doing it. Cause mm-hmm. it was so dark. It was so scary. It was so lonely. I quit my job. I owned my own company. I had just started it with my best friend. We were on the brink of like some of our greatest success. Mm-hmm. We were so excited. Brian was our number one fan, you know, and we had been approached to sell in January and we were like, that's so exciting. That was our 10-year goal. And then Brian got hit and it was like, I don't even care what they want to, what deal they want to do, or mm-hmm. do I have to sell? Right. So we sold and it was like, you know, on paper, such a success. We were mm-hmm. so thrilled for that, but it was almost like I never even had an opportunity to celebrate that.
Right.
Because I was so engrossed in Brian, like in keeping him alive at that point too, just like he was so fragile. And so it was still very scary. And I was still not even like comprehending brain injury and the road ahead at all. Right. But I knew I needed to open myself up, my time and my mind to actually getting him there. Cause it's either you do nothing and sulk in it, or you give it everything you have. So you just lay it all down. You just sacrifice everything you have to do it. And I knew that Brian was the person I was going to lay it all down for when I married him.
Right.
You know what I mean? I looked at him on our wedding day and knew, if anything was ever going to happen to you, I'm promising you now, I'm going to be the one to be there. So
right.
Again, it's like you never want to live through an experience where it tests your virtues and your faith and your vows, but it did. And I was like, okay, well, like it's a no-brainer. I have to do this for him, you know?
Yeah.
But that didn't answer your routine question, but I guess in a roundabout way, you can kind of see.
No, I mean, on Monday, you know, I went home and, I mean, the first thing I said to my wife was, I can't imagine, you know, because my perspective is this would be her, right? Like mm-hmm. she would be the one that wouldn't stop.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's emotional to think through, you know?
Yeah.
Because it literally is taking everything that you said in those vows and it's setting it into motion, which is extraordinary. And it's crazy that I'm getting more emotional over here. I'm trying to keep it together, but because we have worked with many similar situations and it is not common to have that unwavering faith. Mm. And I don't know if you're aware of that because you're so engrossed in your world, but it's not. And what we see is the majority are in the, again, we are not judging. We are never judging anyone, but we see a lot of people that are kind of 1 foot in, 1 foot out. And then some people that completely bail. And again, not judging it. It's everyone's life. You know, they're doing the best they can.
Yeah.
But to have your type of unwavering, I'm going to do it no matter what. Great reference. When I got on the phone with you, I will never forget your comment of, yeah, we're going to get this care flight. We're going to get there. I have no idea how we're going to get back, but whatever. And I'm like, okay. so that sounds great.
Yeah. I just went and looked at an RV that day. So I was like, I guess we're going to buy an RV and I was just going to just drive him.
Right.
But whatever it takes.
Right. I mean, it's just that attitude of I will get there and we'll figure it out from there.
Yeah.
Which is a whole different mental space. Did it take you a while to get into that space?
Yeah, no, like it's instinctual in a lot of ways. Like when I think it's like when you have a genuine love for someone, there's a lot of instincts that just start to kick in, like natural instincts. And so I think for me, from the very jump, it was like a natural thing to just want to be on the front line of it and help Ryan and get him the best care and advocate for him. Even though at the time I remember someone telling me, you're going to have to be Brian's number one advocate. And I was like, duh. And I had no idea what that actually meant. Like looking back at our journey and how many times I really had to just get loud for Brian, like mm-hmm. not just say like, oh, he needs this, but to actually like fight back because there's so much pushback on certain things or things that you expect you'd get in healthcare that you don't. And so I didn't really know. It was like, I was going to have to really like rev up my inner like mm-hmm. loud voice on it just to keep Brian safe in some circumstances. But yeah, there's a lot of mental strength that has had to be built.
Sure.
Like even last night, like I'm really run down. Like mm-hmm. this has been exhausting. I've been planning for months. Didn't expect the pollen to kick my butt.
Yeah.
And then my dog comes and she kept me up all night and I was like, man, there were so many times I almost texted you at 2 and 4 to be like, I can't do it. Like I can't even show up today. And I've never not shown up mm-hmm. with Brian to anything. So I'm like, is this going to be the thing? Like, is this going to be the time that I actually throw the towel in because of allergies and I'm tired? Like I'm tired all the time. So I just kind of have to like tell myself like I'm going to be tired through this. It is what it is. It's going to be tired and do nothing or tired and do it all.
Right.
And that's how I go to sleep at night, I guess, with it is like I can hang my hat on the effort put forth. So and that's what I think I need to.
But. Right. Well, thanks for showing up. I really appreciate it. I think your insight is invaluable because we also have probably even more caregivers that tune in, right? So people in similar scenarios. So let's go back to what you were saying about having to be a voice. Mm. How did that look? And when did you realize like, crap, okay, if I don't say something, something's not going to happen right. Like, did that happen early on?
It was in the first, I would say in the first 3 months that probably happened, which it sounds like a long time. But Brian was in a coma for almost 2 whole. It was like a month and a half before he actually opened his eyes and broke from his own natural coma. Mm-hmm. So at that time it was COVID and I was the only one allowed with Brian in the room and I didn't touch him. I think I rubbed his hands and feet because they were dry, but I was like, we were in basically a nursing home at that time. I didn't know what kind of facility we were in. I don't work in healthcare. That's not my background. So none of the terms made sense to me. I didn't know what level of facility we were in. I just knew he was like laying there and sometimes people would come. They didn't talk to me. They like gave meds. The doctor would round maybe a couple times a week. I I just sat there in the silence with Brian. Yeah. When we got to rehab is where they started to dignify Brian and mm-hmm. get him dressed in the morning, shower him, bring him to a gym, move him, touch him. And I was like, he's not fragile. Like, I can touch him.
Right.
And they're like, what? You should be in bed with him. Like,
right.
you should be, you know, shaving his face. Like, you need to do stuff. And so the rehab facility is really where I was like starting to get comfortable with giving him back life, like right. normal life routine, brushing his teeth, going in the bathroom for that, like just little things. But mm-hmm. I was like really appreciative of their insight and their outlook, even though their outlook was still kind of pessimistic. Their approach with care is where I was like, okay, I can step into that. I can do this all day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So for people listening and maybe they're in the early stages or maybe even the late stages, do you have any practical tips or any type of like, hey, make sure you do X, Y, and Z in regards to using your voice and standing up and, or really anything?
I mean, there's a lot to that. I mm-hmm. think there's a way to use your voice when you start to learn your person's cues. Like with brain injury, it took me a long time to understand like what Brian was trying to communicate or if he was trying to communicate. And so it took me a while to interpret what does it mean when they have tone and what does it mean when he moans? And like, I needed to understand what all that meant. Cause he moved through a lot of those stages where he was like, you know, tremoring at one point and was that a seizure. And then he did have seizures a lot. And just kind of like learning as I went on those things. Once I learned those things, I felt like that's when I could start to tell a nurse more than she could tell me.
Yeah.
For a long time, it was like I was relying on the nurse and the doctor to tell me about my husband. And now I think it's much more the other way where yeah. I'm informing a care team about Brian and they're not informing me. I'm going to inform them.
Yes.
This is what we need to do for him to alleviate that. And this is how you know if he needs this. Mm-hmm. So the confidence to have that is almost like you have to, like for me, I'm a little bit of a, like I'm not afraid to speak up already. So that's like kind of to my advantage as I was already an entrepreneur. I was already comfortable with my voice, but I am a little bit of a people pleaser and I want to make sure people feel welcome and respected everywhere I go. Like I've put that kind of thought into my business and my home with home health and so in an environment where I'm not a professional, like I'm not a neurologist and I'm not a nurse and I'm not a therapist. I didn't want to come off a certain way to them because I do think that there's a human nature element where if there's not mutual respect between us, then it's going to impede Brian's care
right.
anyway. So I was very cognizant of that. And it's very difficult to be someone's voice and be assertive without crossing that line of being offensive.
Right.
And or ignorant. And so that was the biggest challenge for me is how do I be loud and be stern and certain without offending their background and what they know.
Right.
And I think that's where probably most people in my position struggle too, because it's really easy for, and it's happened to me too, very easy for a nurse to walk out of the room and be like, oof, that wife. Like, oh, Brian's wife. And then that turns into an issue with care because then if a whole team of nurses think a certain way about that family in that room, then they don't want to come in there and they don't want to care for Brian the way that they should, even though they, you know, supposed to do no harm. I saw harm done because of the way my actions were being interpreted and my intentions were good.
Right.
You know, my intentions were only to help my husband. And that's it. And so it sucked. That part really sucked. And it's really difficult to navigate.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that all medical providers need to understand, sure, you're not a neurologist, but you are a Brian expert.
Yeah.
And this is something like, so when I teach doctors, like this is literally a topic that we go into. And it's usually a pediatric conversation because yeah. the mom always knows more about that kid than you ever will, period. Mm. Same thing. A wife is always going to know more about that husband than the doctor ever will.
Yeah.
And it's being able to understand as a provider that, hey, when he looks like that, when he's when he makes that sound, when he does these things, like what does that mean to you? Like, how does that,
yeah.
how are you interpreting that? Like mm-hmm. those are important things for healthcare providers to understand.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, not many know that.
Yeah.
And you're right. Some people think, well, I'm the neurologist. And I will tell you that that moan didn't mean anything. Right. And when in fact it actually did, because it may happen consistently with a certain type of action or outcome or whatever. Mm-hmm. And only you have insight to that.
Yeah.
So shame on the healthcare providers for not really wanting that information. That information is gold to us.
Yeah.
Like, just so you know, like, we love that information. We always look for voluntary cues.
Yeah.
The voluntary cues are huge. It means the brain is actually initiating and then trying to carry out a process. And then we can build on that.
Yeah.
So, but that's so important for people to understand. And just a fine line, like, I've never thought about it that way. You don't want to be that group that no one wants to work with.
Yeah.
And how sad that we have to think through that.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a really big hurdle for me. And it just resulted in me being really honest with people, though, from the get-go, and walking into a room very prepared, unless like know-it-all, but just try to be like, how do I look like a prepared wife that is also open to this being collaborative? Mm-hmm. Not me coming in here being like, I know everything about Brian, so we're doing it my way. Because there was such one, I remember times where people would be like, I just want whatever you want, because I would just be doing stuff. And then mm-hmm. I realized I was like intimidating them. And I was like, I'm not trying to do that at all. I'm just tired. I'm stressed. And I want to get this done how I know it works. But yeah, I want to do like mention, though, that we have landed with some incredible doctors.
Yes.
We have won mutual respect with one another.
Yes.
That was an effort put forth on both our parts. And I think right now I feel like it took me 3 years to get to that point, but we have these doctors that now I feel like we have good conversation that revolve around Brian's well-being together. And I am very careful to make sure I'm asking them, what's your opinion on this? Mm-hmm. Or like, I'm noticing this, this, and this about Brian. I need your opinion because I'm not comfortable. What do you think would be the best route forward? And I try to make sure that I'm positioning my questions to them a certain way to make sure they feel valued and respected in their background. But at the same time being like, but I need you to know what I'm seeing at home with Brian. And so we've won respect with each other.
Yeah.
And so we do have a good team now. But in the very beginning, there was a lot of people that were literally said, this is the new Brian.
Yeah.
This is the new Brian. And those are the words that stick in my head when I put my head on the pillow at night. I hear that in my head, that this is the new Brian. And I'm like, I refuse to hold that to be true, because Brian is still Brian.
Yes.
He just suffered an injury, and we don't do that in any other injury. Right. If Brian broke his arm, no one would be like, well, this is the new Brian, broken arm, mm-hmm. deal with it. Like, he's still my husband and he's still in there. And so I refuse to let someone ever do that to him and label him that way.
Right.
Yeah.
And really essentially kind of give up.
Yeah.
You're right. He is in there. And I don't like those comments either. And because they get back to us, you know, that we get ridicule of, you know, why are you doing this to people? There's no way that you're ever going to achieve X, Y, and Z. Right. And then, you know, that person starts doing X, Y, and Z. And mm-hmm. it's like, where are you at now, homie? Yeah. Like, what's going on? I don't hear you anymore.
Explain that. Yeah.
And I guess that's just like the message to drive home is that, look, there is absolutely no one that can look at Brian or someone like Brian and say, hey, in 3 months, he's going to look like this. In 6 months, he's going to look like this. Right. That prognosis is hard. Mm-hmm. No one has a magic crystal ball, but we do have similar cases to point to that we can say, hey, here was a similar situation. This is how it transpired. There's always differences.
Right.
But again, I think that goes back to this concept of, I wish those initial people would do what they do best and then say, hey, that's a great question. Let me connect you with a facility or a doctor that does this long term, and let's get mm-hmm. you some answers that way.
Yeah.
That would be amazing. And I think that will happen. I think honestly, in my career, I have seen a shift to where I've had people like at Dell Children's Hospital, they have reached out to me. Mm-hmm. I have had other physicians that they are now reaching out to me. Yeah. I'd say in the last year, I've had more collaborative efforts with medical staff than I ever have.
That's amazing.
So something's happening.
Yeah.
And that's good. And we'll get there. Okay. So caregiver fatigue. It's a real thing, right? Mm-hmm. Do you do anything for that? Or are you just grinding through and what do you do?
Yeah. Well, we're really lucky that we do have 24/7 care supporting us, which I am not, I don't take that for granted for 1 second. We have a nurse and a CNA with Brian all the time. And I think part of that is that like I have no autonomy and I had to kind of give that up. So like, you know, Brian's room is always being tended to with at least two people all day long, all night long. So I don't sleep in the same bedroom as Brian. I have like converted an office into a little sleeping nook for myself. So I try to look at what do I have instead of what don't I have anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't want to focus too much on, because it's really easy and it's so fast. If I shift my thinking into like, wow, I don't have any autonomy. I don't have my husband. I don't have my job. You can go downhill really fast and then fatigue and burnout happens faster. Meltdowns, all of it. I'm not saying I don't have those days. Those days definitely come in abundance, especially with time. But what I do have is a really nice roof over my head and help. And so I rest. And so I take my sleep very seriously, like very seriously, like mm-hmm. to the point where people make fun of me, but whatever. I go to bed early. I wind down with myself, my dog. I make sure I get at least 8 hours of sleep, because if I'm not at my best, I cannot even think about Brian's stuff. It's just impossible.
Yeah.
So it's whittled down to the basics, but I try to make those things really fun for myself. So when I go to my room and like go to bed, like I'll give myself a facial and I'll put, you know, my favorite show on or get my dog and like make a cup of tea or something. But I try to make my environment and like those moments like really matter and like really wring out like as much joy from those things as I can. And just so I can get up and do it again. Cause I know it's a Groundhog's Day. It's not fun, but if I don't find the joy in it and I don't rest, it's going to be impossible.
Yeah.
So just learning that about myself too is like, I've always been a worker, somebody I will love to work. And so in some ways, taking on Brian's stuff is like having a job or mm-hmm. five with legal and medical and all that. So I just applied that to his health. And so everything is organized and color coded. And like, I get joy out of that. So I know that's not everybody's thing, but I just am applying what I know I'm good at and mm-hmm. applying it to Brian's stuff.
Yeah.
And then I just try to stay social as well, like with my family, with my friends. You know, if someone wants to help, I just say yes. That was hard in the beginning. When people want to help you, it's humbling. Now people want to do things. I'm like, yep, do that. You know, like just taking what people want to offer and accepting it like with gratitude is better than telling like people no all the time, because people really do want to help. The nature of people is mostly good.
Sure.
And so I just think like learning how to accept the help and lean into that, and then like applying what you're innately good at already and rest. Those are the ways that I do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's really important for others to understand, you know, because they hear us talk about, okay, you need to exercise this much and you need to do your cold plunges and you need to do your vagus nerve stimulus and lay under your light panels and do all this kind of stuff. And, you know, and it's important, while all of those are fantastic things, it's not really feasible sometimes, right? And so it's important for people to hear this, that know how you need to accept that care for yourself.
Yeah.
Right? Because some people may,
like,
just thought of a caregiver right now, loves to run. She's going to go for like a 10-mile run.
Yeah.
You know, that's like your nap.
Yeah. Yeah.
So understanding yourself and what you really need. And really what you're talking about is a story of efficiency, right? Mm-hmm. Being efficient at gathering that rest. Because when you were talking about sleep, I'm like, how much sleep are you talking about? 8 hours? Mm-hmm. Shoot, that's not much. I mean, that's like, that's a normal amount of sleep. But really not taking it for granted and making it worth the 8 hours.
Yeah.
That's important to understand. Do you feel like that routine that you have established, is that enough? Do you need to add to it? Do you need to, like, how much help do you need at this point for yourself?
Yeah, I mean, it would
I know,
be,
I remember I adjusted you, so I got to feel how much tension was in there.
Yeah, yeah, it was a lot. I would love to have more time to commit to, like, I would love to exercise. I've carved out 2 days a week to exercise. I would love to get that up, but the reality of Brian's, like, unpredictability up until coming here, is it's just you never really know what a day is going to look like and if we're going to the ER or not. So there's always a little bit of fight or flight that you're living in and kind of on the edge of your seat for, like, I'm waking up and I had a good sleep, but I really don't know what I'm waking up to. Mm-hmm. Like, is Brian going to be in there and the nurses are going to tell me, hey, rough night, got to go to the hospital. Mm-hmm. I don't know. And so I think that's a really difficult thing to, like, build a routine around, because yeah. I kind of need to make myself available all the time. So I don't know if that answers that, but.
Sure. Well, so is there something that yourself now would tell Lauren back then? Is there something that you'd be like, hey, let that go, do this, focus on this? Like, is there some kind of advice that you would have given your past self?
It's hard because the circumstances surrounding, like, the timing of Brian's accident being with COVID mm-hmm. was that there wasn't other visitors allowed. So mm-hmm. I think ideally I would have told myself, like, take more breaks from the hospital.
Yeah.
I couldn't though. And he was still actually very, he took a long time to stabilize.
Yeah.
So once he came out of that coma, he had pneumonia, he had seizures, he had neurostorming. He had a lot of emergency situations that were, like, not even, they were weekly.
Yeah.
And I was doing the best I could to, if I couldn't stay with my parents, I was staying in a comfortable environment where I could get sleep. That was, like, a big deal to me. Then it's hard. I think I feel really good about the way I navigated it in the end. Like mm-hmm. when I look back at it all, and I think we're still just too early into, like, transitioning into home health and learning a routine, and even myself, like, in the home health goals I had for myself, like, I wanted to work out again and I wanted to make my own meals. That was, like, something I really missed, was I was sick of eating out. And so mm-hmm. I'm really proud of, like, the way that I've been able to just make simple goals. Like, hey, I want to just cook. I want to sleep in my own bed, my dog, and I want to work out twice a week, you know, yeah. something is attainable. And then, like, and then I feel very rewarded by that. And it's really just come down to almost, like, survival sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think the one thing I would change about what I did was I would have touched him more. Like yeah. I do feel guilty about kind of, like, feeling like I couldn't touch him or I couldn't aid or assist with the nurses. Like, it's totally okay to assist the medical staff and touch your person. And I wish I would have done that more.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Well, let's talk about goals, right? So I know that communication is a big goal, yeah. right? So I'll turn it to you actually. So what did you see initially, right? So we started to get some progress in how Brian could communicate. Mm. Can you give us a little bit of detail around that? What did that look like?
Here?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it was with Dr. Whitman. Mm-hmm. She put a marker in his hand and then with a whiteboard and started asking him to write a straight line for yes and an arc, kind of like a lowercase n for no. Mm-hmm. And he was able to do it. So we asked him 10 questions that only he would know. And he got all 10 right with the line and the arc, which was awesome. Especially because I had it in my head from something somebody said early on, was like, if somebody does something 3 times, it's not reliable. If they do something 4 times in a row, it's no longer a coincidence. And so that's all I thought of when I saw the 10 questions was like 100% right, 10 for 10 in a row. I was like, this is maybe the first time that my brain isn't processing this as a coincidence, like, or fake, you know, yeah. like Brian will say a word. He's spoken like a dozen times, maybe just one word phrases. And every time I'll convince myself by the next day that it didn't happen or like we heard it wrong. We mm-hmm. interpreted it wrong. But that is like, I looked at that piece of paper, I put it on the fridge. It was like kid art, you know, it was like, he did it 10 times. And like, yeah. my brain can't tell me he didn't now.
Exactly.
So
nor can anyone else.
Right.
And nor can anyone deny that he's not in there.
Right.
He is in there.
Right.
He's talking to us.
Yeah.
So with that being done, does that make you go back and go, okay, well, those words were purposeful.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
What were those words? I don't remember.
He said my name once, and then he said, okay, no. He said, good morning. He said, stop. Things like that. Mm-hmm. They're all appropriate.
Yeah.
And like more than one person can hear them. And I also believe that like if more than one person interprets English, then it happened.
Right.
Like we don't just accidentally hear English words, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So
that's amazing. So with that, you know, I was explaining this yesterday. They said, why does he get so tired? Just is, you know, trying to write that line or that in. And I was explaining, you know, the brain is all about safety and efficiency. Mm-hmm. And like, if I were to go and make a line, well, my brain would initiate it, you know, it would say, I want to make a line. And then it would just send that information down. And then I have these fixed action patterns that would take over unconsciously, right? Because this is an efficiency story. And I wouldn't have to think about it. It would just happen because mm-hmm. my brain has done this and it knows what to do and how to do it. But with Brian, he's learning. And so he's having to go, okay, I got to hold the pen tighter. Okay, I got to keep this angle. I got to pull down.
Yeah.
I got to pull down more. I got to go in this direction, right? So he's having to piece this together muscle by muscle, mm-hmm. thought by thought, right? And then that will turn into a more efficient process. But in the initial term, right, I compared it to a baby learning how to walk. You know, they first stand up and they're all wobbly and they fall over and they do it over and over again. And then they become more efficient at it. And then they don't think about it. They just walk. It's the same process, right? And so understanding how this, I don't want to say little thing, but this huge accomplishment, I don't see it. This is me. I don't see it as, okay, great. We got a yes, no. I see it as what's to come. I see it as he's mentally processing. He's able to understand the question. Mm-hmm. He's able to then give a response and the response is accurate.
Yeah.
And then he's able to coordinate his hand, his muscles and everything so that he can then communicate what that thought is. That tells us clinically, oh my gosh, there's a lot of potential there. And now we can leverage that to build plasticity other places, mm-hmm. right? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's huge. And I think that's another gap in healthcare is that maybe they don't see that potential. Maybe they don't see that potential in the facial tone.
Yeah.
They don't see that potential in, well, I can stimulate this reflex. That means we have a lot mm-hmm. to build here, right?
Yeah.
Because I don't think any of those, like, has anyone ever communicated those things to you?
Neuroplasticity has been communicated a little bit in rehab settings, mostly mm-hmm. from a therapy point of view. And, like, I think that the healthcare space is just kind of designed to treat the problem and get on to the next mm-hmm. patient. It's a lot of volume. And so I think that's probably a big reason why, but you're right. There needs to be some kind of handoff then and not so much of, cause it's like, maybe it's just not their place to speak to it because they never have the opportunity to see a patient through long-term because they're saving the next life, you know?
Right.
And so there's a role for them. They save Brian's life.
Absolutely.
A lot of respect for that, but there was no handoff. It was like, good luck.
Yeah.
Go into your home and good luck to you.
Yes.
And so it took a lot to even find your clinic and practice and anything like it. It took a lot of research and dedication to that kind of research to uncover that this isn't even in the realm of possibility.
Right.
Yeah.
We have some interesting tattoos. Do you mind telling us a little bit about some of these?
Yeah. So I think this is the one. 76 is a cop code for en route. Mm-hmm. And so Brian used to text me 76 home at the end of all shifts. Or sometimes just 76. So that was the last text I got from him when he was on his way home to switch his boots out. And so since I think he's still on his way home, I got that tattooed for him just to kind of keep going.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What about the Greek word?
Dunamai. So me and a couple other wives that went in the rehab hospital got it. And it's Greek derivative from dunamis, which is, or I'm probably butchering that pronunciation too, so hopefully no judgment there.
You're in Texas. We say things wrong all the time.
Okay, cool. but it literally means dynamite. That's the literal translation of it. And so in scripture, I need to find the actual scripture it is.
Okay.
So I can reference it. But it's God is exceedingly abundantly able mm-hmm. to do more than we ask or imagine. And so in the original context in Greek, they used the word dunamai because there wasn't a word for miracle or like something that would encompass the miracles they saw like Jesus performing. So that's kind of how they broke down like the meaning of that verse. And so that's Yeah, I believe that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's very encompassing of your story and your, you know, how you're approaching everything with Brian, and there's great things coming.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you would like to communicate to people listening? Any kind of words of wisdom or anything that we didn't get to?
We didn't talk about like the PRP.
We can talk about anything you want.
I think that's a cool thing to talk about, because a lot of people have been asking me like what that's about.
Yeah, absolutely.
So just kind of like, maybe I can just ask you that, like, how do you think that that will supplement in addition to what you've already been doing, you know, now that you're, because it's a newer treatment, right?
Yes.
You started? Okay.
It absolutely is. So what we did was the laser enhanced PRP, and we're focused on the V cells. So very small embryonic like stem cells. So during this process, we activated those stem cells by drawing his blood, you know, spin centrifuging it down into the plasma. And then we use a specific laser to activate those V cells, which is a big reason why in medicine no one really uses them, because they are dormant. And so we activate them and then readminister, and then, you know, specifically target the networks in the brain. We actually also targeted the lungs because of the recurrent infections that he's had. And the concept there is that we want those V cells to migrate to the specific areas that we're targeting. So it's a regenerative procedure. And what we want is we want those cells to go take up shop in those injured networks and those areas that we targeted for the immune system and begin to rebuild, right? Because they are a pluripotent stem cell. And it's important to understand pluripotent versus multipotent. Like, if, you know, most people think of mesenchymal stem cells, sometimes those mesenchymal stem cells have already started to differentiate into a certain tissue type. So maybe they have already taken that step towards being a muscle cell or a heart cell or whatever it may be. So that's a multipotent stem cell. The V cell is pluripotent, meaning it can turn into anything. And with the wavelength of light that we use on it, it actually encourages that cell to become what's called a neurosphere, which is its first step towards being a neurological stem cell, right? So it can turn into a neuron or whatever it needs to be. So what we're looking for is we told those cells where to go, and then we combined it with this process of where we say we imprint these cells, right, with the goals and what we want to see them do, right? That's this whole other mind-body component, which I think is really important to acknowledge. A lot of the leading research right now is actually looking at this cell-to-cell communication. We know that happens. But our cells have this innate intelligence within them, and they're always listening. The cells in your toes are listening to the cells in your shoulder and vice versa, right? And so it's not a far stretch to go, well, those cells are also listening to me outside of your body and all the things going on, right? And there's several different references I could point to justify that. And so we believe it's vitally important, if we have this cell that has the ability to turn into anything, if we imprint it with the goals and aspirations and the prayers, right, as we're administering them, we're talking to those cells. We're saying, this is what That's cool. we want you to do. This is what we want the outcome to be. And then we reinforce that daily, whether someone listens to the recording of these goals being said and these prayers being said, or they're saying them out loud again. It's almost like we're reinforcing those cells as they're replicating. But yeah, that's my job, right?
Yeah.
I think I explained it one time where we're sending in the army, right? Mm-hmm. And then those troops, they went to battle, and now they're, you know, they're in the trenches, and we're reinforcing them. Like, remember, this is why you went in. Keep fighting, keep doing the good work. And so what we want to see is an acceleration of neuroplasticity for Brian. And that's what we've seen consistently with other patients, is this is a huge ability for us to accelerate that change. We want to get there faster. We want to break through plateaus. It helps us to decompensate someone faster, right? So there's compensation that occurs. So it helps us to lengthen muscles faster. It helps us to build brain networks faster. We focused on various networks in the brain, specifically networks that are going to help him move better, speak better, and do those things. And like I said, the immune health. I want to see the lung infections really, really go away. I don't want any more chronic respiratory or any type of infectious burden. So that was a big goal. And we've done this actually, by the way, I don't know if I told you, we've done this in people that have had chronic infections, and it actually did reduce their infectious burden. It actually did help them to not get sick. Right. Yeah. So that's why we did it the way we did it. So that's the goal. I want to see him not be sick. I want to see him move better, talk better, communicate better. Like, that is absolutely the goal with that. And I do think that we're going to see that. And here's a great thing. Those cells are going to continue to replicate. We're going to see them, I don't want to say peak, but it's going to be like 2 weeks before we can go, okay, this is really these cells starting to take place.
Yeah.
Obviously, we see things faster. Like, we will see things even the day after sometimes. Yeah. But then those effects are going to continue even over the next few months. It's exciting.
Yeah.
And we've gotten reports back even 6 months after doing one procedure of things still changing.
Yeah.
So it's a huge way to really just boost and bolster everything that you're doing and everything that we're doing. So yeah, I hope that that helps. So here, I'll hand this over to you.
All right.
You can, if you have any questions for me, which obviously we have some things that, you know, we kind of prepared and talked about. This is a cool opportunity. You know, I don't get asked questions on the spot very often.
Okay.
I did not look at that, by the way.
Okay.
I literally didn't. I only looked at, you know, the part that I was thinking about for you.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Talked about some of this kind of by the nature, but okay, this is a good one. I like this. Are there any limitations of photobiomodulation?
That's a great question. Okay. So do I go on my soapbox or not? I thoroughly believe that a lot of limitations in the rehab space are created by the actual doctors and caregivers or providers that are working with the patient. And you did kind of touch on that a little bit, right? With, hey, this is what you have, accept it, move on, et cetera. I do think that the mindset of the care team is huge, because if we think those limitations are there and we don't think that you can get past them, how are you going to think that, right? How how is that person that is coming to me for change, right, going to change whenever I tell them, no, that's just not possible? When the fact of the matter is, no one can really say that, right? Because maybe it is possible. And I've seen enough so far that where I can go, holy crap, literally anything is possible.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen people come out of coma. I did have one of those dramatic Hollywood experiences where someone just woke up out of a coma.
Really?
I did see that. Yes, I did. One time. You know, so that can happen.
Yeah.
But in regards to photobiomodulation, I will tell you the limitation is in the methodology and the application. It's also in the beam physics. And that's something that I don't talk about a whole lot. But the type of laser beam that someone uses actually has a dramatic effect. Think about it this way. If I take a magnifying glass and I go outside, I can start burning stuff, right? I can focus the sun's light, the energy, I can burn whatever. Conversely, if I diverge the light, that's going to greatly affect the dosage. Well, there's other parameters that you can influence in a laser beam. And that's what we've done over the past year and a half with designing the new lasers that we have coming out. But I can influence the power, the dosage, how we actually talk to cells by changing things like the pulse width and the frequency and the divergence and all of these things with the laser beam. So that's one thing that 99% of providers don't even understand, is that when you read a study, okay, well, what was the laser beam used?
Yeah.
How does that compare with what we have? Because there's a big difference.
Yeah.
There's a huge difference, actually. So the limitations come down to the methodology and the type of beam physics that are being applied. And currently, right now, there's nothing to compare what we do to anything else. And that's why we are having to do our own research. So the limitations, I think, are endless, right? I don't think that there's a glass ceiling on anyone. And I'm talking from me to you right now. Like, this is not for anyone else. When you look at the current research, you will see things that are stated that says photobiomodulation has the potential to have a great effect on some of the most complex neurological disorders, right? I'm paraphrasing. So even in the literature, it is being said right now that we don't know what the limitation is. And part of it is because we don't know exactly what's going on within the cell, besides the electron transport chain, besides that we're improving energy in the cell, right? And that is just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
Dr. Hamblin wrote a really good paper, I think early this year or late last year, and it said going beyond cytochrome C oxidase. And what he was saying is there's so many different things going on with the use of laser and light therapy. Most people focus on this complex called cytochrome C oxidase in the cell, which is part of the electron transport chain that produces ATP within the cell. And so I was like, oh my gosh, this is going to be amazing. I can't wait to read this. And then I read through it and it was a great paper. Don't get me wrong. But I was like, okay, that didn't really get me to the next level because he talked about things that really have already been stated in literature. And I was like, bummer. It was a great paper. Go read it. Not saying, not deterring anyone. But where it gets exciting for me is in the quantum physics world, because we know this is not a debate. We're just a bunch of atoms, right? Just like we know we're just a bunch of cells. Mm-hmm. And there's really good research out there and good data being pulled that electrons and photons really like to interact. Photons actually have this preferential interaction with electrons. So when I'm using laser therapy on a patient, it's very important for me to understand what's going on at the molecular level, but also the atomic and subatomic level. And that's where the future of photobiomodulation is going. That's where we're going with mm-hmm. it. Even with the V-cell, right? Even with that procedure, what I didn't get into is the quantum component of it. And even Dr. Levine and myself, we didn't even get into it because it is a really complicated thing.
Yeah.
But again, for me to you, this was a question. I want to kind of give you a little window into this. So when that photon, when we're applying those photons to someone, it's interacting with electrons and those electrons are being nudged into higher orbits. So we're increasing the energy in those atoms in that person. Mm-hmm. Now, that energy doesn't stop there. It's still being transferred. So now that electron has to come back, right? So we created a gravitational force. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So we have the opportunity to fill that void with what we want to attract. And this is another part of why setting the goals and reading the prayers and doing all those things at the time of application is important too, because we're creating a void space and a gravitational force on a quantum level that we need to acknowledge. And so if someone's just sitting there holding a laser, thinking about what they're going to do that day or whatever it is, we're not really getting to the full potential of what we could be doing, right? And so I hope that you've seen in our practice that we are fully intent when we're working with someone. Of course, we're having conversations and we're doing those things, mm-hmm. but we all understand how important it is to be 100% engaged and be thinking through what we're trying to achieve in that moment, because that's where you're going to see the limitations of what can and cannot be achieved. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I don't think even though I experienced all of it and was part of it all, I didn't really realize even to like what level that was thought through. You know, I just thought I was like, oh, this is a great experience, but you're actually like thinking through it on a scientific level too, which is cool.
I have to.
Yeah.
Well, to be frankly honest, I've explained what I just said to you to two other people.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you. I feel privileged.
It's a deep topic that takes a lot of thought and substantiation so that you don't sound like a weirdo.
Yeah.
But again, it's mostly quantum physics.
Yeah, it's like a loaded question, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, cool. I think I only have like one other burning question because I feel like we covered a lot of this other stuff, but like, has there ever been someone who has inquired for help that you turned away that you feel like you could help?
Yes.
Okay.
There has been. So I never want to give false hope. And that's something that I think is very important. And I actually just explained this to someone on your care team yesterday mm-hmm. too. I only want to engage with people that I know we can help.
Yeah.
Now, it doesn't happen often, but there are people out there that I don't think are the best fit for what we do. Or what most commonly happens, perhaps what we do is ancillary and they need to pursue this first, right? Mm-hmm. And so we will give them that directive. okay, hey, I need you to follow up with this provider. I need you to do this first and then come to us or work with us in parallel with this other collaborative effort. It's only fair to the patient, but it's also fair to us and in maintaining the integrity of what we're doing.
Right.
Because I have come across other providers that just say yes to everything. I even had there was someone that was working with a traumatic brain injury patient in a different state, and they shouldn't have been. And they were actually telling the person to not pursue other types of care. Don't go to PT. Don't go to OT. Mm. We can do everything here. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, it's really about what's best for the patient.
Yeah.
And that's how this should be, pursued on our end. So
some of the whole.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, and not only have, yes, we've turned away some people, but we've even started to work with someone and we've said, hey, I don't think this is a great fit. And we give them the reason and then we give them a referral, right? Yeah. But that's only fair to them.
Yeah. No, I think that was an important question, just even from our own community of people who are like, you know, why this clinic? Why Texas? You know, why are you doing all this? Like, isn't there something here like it? You know, and there are, of course, clinics in Chicago. You know, there's all kinds of medical availability there. But it was really difficult for me to explain everything you just explained. And like, kind of, that's what I gathered from reading about what you do and how you do it and everything. But it's really difficult to translate that to people. Like, you don't understand, it's different. And I don't know really the best way to articulate it the way you did. But I think that's a burning question for our community. It's like, why all this? Why are you doing all this for Brian to get him to Texas? Can't you just stay in Illinois and do something similar?
Right.
Can't you just, you know, I think we even talked about that when I was like, can you come here? Can you come to Chicago and just like eliminate all this chaos? Now I get it. I got it then. I was just like really desperate to like simplify at the time. Mm-hmm. But I think that's just like a good way to, I don't know, put it out there that like there's a reason why we came all the way here for this, because it's so specific and it's so different than anything else I've found. So
yeah. Awesome. Well, I do appreciate your time. Yeah. I know that you are tired. I know that we're both getting hit with the Texas pollen at the moment, and that's no fun. But, you know, literally, you're going to help so many people and in so many different regards. But I really hope that everything that you shared today is going to, even if we just help one person, it was worth it. So thank you so much for showing up today. But thank you so much for showing up every day for Brian. Your strength and resilience is beyond imaginable for me. So thank you so much for everything you do. So appreciative for you. And yeah, I'm so honored and happy to be along on this journey with you.
Well, thank you. And thank you. And to your whole team too, for treating Brian with just such love and kindness and like looking at us like real people and not like a sad case. I can't tell you just how good even Haley has noticed it. My whole family, it's just really nice to be seen as who we are and not just a tragedy. So I really, really value that. And you've done a good job of cultivating that in your office. So
your shirt. So we were talking about, you know, I'm going to order shirts for the whole staff, right? and I wish I would have done it already. I would have wore it today. But there's a foundation, right? Mm-hmm. And there's something special about it that you were just explaining earlier, where Brian is one of the only troopers, right, that was not actually killed in the line of duty, right? So this is a different situation.
Yeah. There's been a lot of injury in the line of duty, but catastrophic injury in the state of Illinois, Brian is one of the first and only that'd be like a very long-term recovery, you know, disabled in the line of duty. So one of the troopers that Brian never really worked directly with him, but he's one of the state troopers that now we're friends with. He started the Got Your Six Foundation for a friend of his that was killed in the line of duty. He raised funds for the family and he started this to kind of cope with, you know, there's a lot of unfortunate deaths in the line of duty in the nature of law enforcement. So he started this organization to really rally around the families that need it, unfortunately more than he probably would like to, because it just happens too often. And so when Brian got injured, he reached out to me and he's really just bolstered up our family, and he's done a lot of events, fundraisers, selling shirts, stickers, patches, that kind of thing. But he's a huge driving force forward for why we really do keep going and looking for more things to do, because he's already got the community, like, you know, looking and waiting to help the next family that needs it. So he's done quite a bit for us in selling the shirts, and yeah, even the shirts themselves being the token of raising awareness. Like, I'll see Frank Strong shirts in random towns, you know, or stickers on car. I'll be driving in a random town, there's like a Frank Strong sticker somewhere. Wow. And so every time there's a sighting, we'll like post about it. And it's kind of it's become a neat thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if someone wanted to donate or support you, where do they go? How do they do that?
Yeah. They can follow the Got Your Six Foundation on Instagram or on Facebook. And then my Instagram has a link to our GoFundMes as well.
So. Okay. Perfect. Well, yeah, we'll absolutely get all decked cool. out, right?
All right.
We'll even carry stuff in the office. That'd be fantastic.
Sweet. Thank you.
But yeah, please, if you're, you know, listening, you want to help out Lauren and Brian, please just go in there, follow them. And that's important too. Follow. Let's continue with this progress. Let's see where we go here, right? It's going to be amazing. As always, if you know of someone that this podcast could benefit, please share it. Please share it, because that's the only reason why we are here, is to help others. So thank you so much, and I look forward to talking to you next time.
We hope today's episode has inspired you to take that next step toward your best self. Remember, the path to longevity is paved with small daily decisions. Your journey is unique, and every step, every choice brings you closer to your ultimate vision of a healthier, happier life. For more insights, tips, and resources, visit drbrandoncrawford.com.